You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Our power doesn't come from some self-declared savior promising that he alone can restore order as long as we do things his way. We don't look to be ruled.
President Barack Obama disendorses Donald Trump while endorsing Hillary Clinton, who accepts the Democratic nomination tonight. My guests Rosemary Hollis and Shashank Joshi will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the decision by French media to cease publishing the pictures and even the names of terrorists. But what if the terrorists aren't just doing it for the publicity? And Syria, where humanitarian corridors are on offer for the remaining citizens of Aleppo, and where the rebel al-Nusra militia has parted ways with Al-Qaeda. And what would 340-year-old cheese taste like? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University here in London, and Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome both to the show. We are going to start tonight in France, where several news organisations have announced a partial withdrawal from the symbiotic relationship which has long existed between the media and terrorism. Le Monde, BFM TV and La Croix are among those which, from now on, will not publish the photographs of terrorists, while Europe One Radio said it wouldn't broadcast their names either. Le Monde's editorial explaining the decision said it wanted to avoid the potential effect of posthumous glorification. Rosemary, my initial reaction to this is that this is a bit daft. Am I wrong?
Well, I wouldn't say it was daft. I can very much see the logic of it, because, not least because, we know that when you have mass killings and these are broadcast around on the internet, irrespective of ISIS or any other organization, it would appear that there are people out there who take this as an inspiration and who are sick, sadly attracted to mass violence and get ideas. And that could be stopped if there's less publicity. And certainly there's a reason when you're up against terrorism to want to deny the terrorists any publicity that they can exploit. But having said all of that, I think the idea that we need information and it's the job of the media to try and give us accurate information tends to trump those other considerations.
Because my argument would be that you mentioned the spectacle. My argument would be that now, especially with the modern terrorism, the spectacle is all. I mean, can anybody, without looking it up, name the guy who drove the truck in Nice?
Boilhedge, something like that. I may be mangling an Algerian name.
But this is my point. Yes, their names and their faces are immaterial. But the spectacle is all.
Well, I don't think that's... I think the imagery and is key. And I think of this in the context of ISIS's high-definition, multi-angled, theatrical videos, particularly, right? So, of course, it's in the beheading, it's in the mass killing, the chilling mechanical nature of it. But it's also in the way it's filmed, presented, disseminated. And I think this policy of not using names or images slightly misses the point that the propaganda of the deed is not in the raw reporting. It's not in the name of the individual or his description of his act or the photo of his grainy mugshot. It's in the way you present it. Glamorizing is not the same as reporting. And there must be a way we can strike a balance in not putting ISIS's own visual propaganda out there, kneeling hostages, orange jumpsuits, their own imagery designed to chill and strike terror, but we can, of course, report names. This is what reporting is, and it will have a number of weird consequences for researchers, for example, if we don't see these details.
Okay, I see absolutely the points that you're making, but we seem to have moved on slightly from the first period when everybody was so alarmed by the slick ISIS videos to the period where ISIS seems simply to be encouraging and inspiring all sorts of lone wolf pack imitative actions around Europe. And in the case of Nice, and in the case of the episode in the killing of the priest in the church, we don't have any ISIS videos, slick or otherwise, and we are purely reliant on reporting. Now, it is the case, it seems to me, that a lot of news media have for a very long time had rules about how much raw violence you can show.
Yeah, indeed.
So it could be considered an extension of that. What the only addition to which is this business of the names.
Is there not, though, to follow that up, Rosemary, a question of... it's become known as the Streisand effect, I think, after Barbara Streisand's attempts to stop people taking pictures of her house, which, of course, just led more people to look up pictures of her house, that the more you try to suppress this, that you actually add a kind of luster to it. You prompt... Nothing provokes curiosity in people like telling them they can't know something or can't see something.
Well, added to which, I think, I for one, have had my estimation of... a lot of media sources completely undermined. I thought there was some kind of rules about accuracy, but in the experience of Brexit, it seems, and also if you listen to the remarks of Donald Trump, how the publicity is all, accuracy is very little to do with what's getting reported these days in the news. So I think we're into a new kind of problem in that respect.
But if we're talking about the mimicry aspect, the emulation and the cascade effect, I think it's important to remember where these copycat attackers are likely getting their ideas from. They are getting it from closed or semi-closed social media networks, Telegram, WhatsApp groups of Islamist networks,
which aren't reliant on Le Monde anyway.
France 24, I mean,
however,
you know, they're
the
not reading
Le
Figaro
is.
And deciding, you know, they're copying their attacks on that basis.
No, I'm talking about the public reaction. Fair enough.
Yes, and I think there's two pathways here, two audiences being addressed, I think.
True enough. Shashank, to follow that point up, though, is there not an assumption underpinning this move by these French media outlets that the motivations for terrorism are possibly the least troubling imaginable motivations for terrorism, i.e. a desire for publicity and vainglory? Is this skating around the possibility that these people are actually doing this out of religious conviction?
Yes, but I don't think the intention is necessarily addressed at the perpetrators. I don't think it's addressed to deter them from gaining publicity. I think it's designed to stop the act from gaining publicity. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. Perpetrators may not want publicity for themselves. They may be in it for genuinely zealous religious motives. And that, of course,
or
may be...
Or a Hitler cult, as we know. In the
Well, I mean, those two things are not unconnected. And in that sense, what you do is stop their cause from getting publicity. So I'm mildly sympathetic to that. I am delighted this is at least a voluntary initiative and that we're not at least talking about states doing this, which would trouble me much more and take us back to some sort of days of barring Sinn Féin voices and having voiceovers.
This was the comparison I was, of course, going to make, Rosemary, that the bizarre interlude in British broadcasting where it was not permitted to broadcast the voices of Sinn Féin's representatives, but you could show their images, which the news media then did show, and getting various unemployed comedians, actors and impressionists to do the voice behind them. I always thought that that whole thing could have been subverted instantly the first time somebody just showed Gerry Adams with Donald Duck's voice or something.
Could we not have Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi with sort of Benny Hill music in the background and sort of, you know, someone for...
Well, look, now we're getting into the territory of Charlie Hebdo. I think we have to be really careful. With the Irish thing, what I'm conscious of is that I've learnt a great deal more recently about exactly how the Irish conflict proceeded. And the whole dirty campaign in the cells, prisoners under detention protesting that they weren't being treated as political prisoners, and plastering the walls with their own feces, and refusing to wear prison uniforms and wearing blankets instead. Actually, the government did a pretty good job at the time at suppressing publicity for all of those kinds of elements of the political campaigning by the warring sides. And so it wasn't just farcical in retrospect that they managed to keep Sinn Féin spokesmen off the media in person. There was much more going on in terms of suppressing information. And there's reason for us to be very concerned about that. But I go back to the point I was making earlier. If we're talking about tabloid media looking for sensationalism in order to sell news or to sell their coverage of so-called news, then I have no confidence that we can rely on the peddlers of such news to take into consideration what might actually incite.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Philadelphia, where later tonight Hillary Clinton will formally accept the Democratic Party's nomination for the US presidency. Last night, the party's big guns fired an extensive salute with enthusiastic salvos from vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, Vice President Joe Biden, and President Barack Obama, who of course beat Clinton to the nomination 8 years ago. Let's hear a little first of Biden and Obama from last night. Biden begins with his thoughts on Hillary Clinton's rival.
His cynicism is unbounded. His lack of empathy and compassion can be summed up in a phrase I suspect he's most proud of having made famous. You're fired. I mean, really, I'm not joking. Think about that. Think about everything you learned as a child. No matter where you were raised, how can there be pleasure in saying you're fired? He's trying to tell us he cares about the middle class. Give me a break. That's a bunch of malarkey. He has no clue about what makes America great. Actually, he has no clue, period.
America is already great. America is already strong. And I promise you, our strength, our greatness, does not depend on Donald Trump. In fact, it doesn't depend on any one person. And that, in the end, may be the biggest difference in this election. And now I'm ready to pass the baton and do my part as a private citizen. So this year, in this election, I'm asking you to join me to reject cynicism and reject fear and to summon what is best in us to elect Hillary Clinton as the next president of the United States.
The President of the United States, before him the Vice President, doing great work reintroducing the word malarkey into the popular discourse. Shashank, Obama wasn't just talking about Trump. He did, of course, talk about Hillary Clinton. He said there has never, his carefully chosen word, been anyone more qualified for the job. I think you could hear a certain disturbance in the tombs of Washington and Jefferson there. But is that
what do they ever do?
Yeah, is that forgivable hyperbole?
I think it's a little bit laying it on thick. And actually, the problem is it touches a raw nerve because it goes to the heart of what many Trump supporters and even many neutrals, I suspect, dislike about Hillary. They see her, what we see as supreme qualification as Secretary of State, as a senator, as a first lady who did important policy initiatives in office.
A number of people see as supreme qualification. I have some sympathy with the Democrats who were so in love with what Bernie Sanders had to offer.
No, but
they find it really hard to regard her as a prime candidate for the job because of her experience. That is part of her problem, I think.
Well, yeah, of course. And the point is, all that experience is seen as Washington, is seen as establishment, is seen as being inside the system,
and
in the Beltway.
Obama himself ran as an outsider candidate 8 years ago.
Precisely. That's exactly right. It's a community organizer rather than someone who had been in politics since the 1970s. And really, this could be Hillary's Achilles heel. So was Obama, one understands his desire to show her as a important candidate in her own right, and to show the sheer contrast between this dangerous buffoon and this competent leader and administrator. But actually, I wonder if this turns people off.
And
who are not us.
Putting up some hostages to fortune. I thought his choice of imagery and his choice of where to put the emphasis was a little bit curious, and I'm sure you're right, but he wasn't granting her all that experience when he was running against her.
Well, of course, but he really wouldn't.
Exactly.
That's in the past.
So this is all for effect in the Democratic convention.
I think he has come to respect her, though. Her time as Secretary of State was an important one. She was in some ways a more stable, calm leader than John Kerry has been, who has been slightly, has had a more difficult time in office, I think, than Hillary has in some respect. So I think he's come to respect her. The famous phrase, of course, from 2008, was it? Hillary, you're likable enough. But really, in a way, he's transcended that and says, well, I don't need to like you, I respect you. And in a way, that's the ultimate accolade.
Rosemary, as you were saying there, Hillary Clinton's background and experience is obviously going to be a mixed blessing. Barack Obama there was promising to go out and campaign hard for Hillary Clinton. Ex-presidents on the campaign trail, also something of a mixed blessing, either because the public don't like them, which is why George W. Bush barely campaigned for any of his successors, or often they can kind of make people wish that they were still running for a third term.
Well, this is what's extraordinary about this election, and the Americans are all saying it, they've never been here before. And what's brought Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama together is we've got to stop this man. And something else new was that he was responding to what they were saying on Twitter as it was being said at the Democratic convention. And he took issue with what Obama said about we don't need to make this country great again, it is great. And he said, try telling those that are unemployed and suffering
that
it's great.
Which is not
exactly
not an unreasonable point, in fairness to Donald Trump, although one might doubt the sincerity with which it was typed or tweeted.
Well, no, I thought, surely we've had a British Prime Minister in the past, you've never had it so good, a fatal mistake to tell the people that they're lucky,
guess,
that the country's great.
See also, I guess, crisis what crisis, so I think that was somewhat apocryphal. But Shashank, is this, how careful do the Democrats need to be about this? The key line of Michelle Obama's great speech the other night was, you know, they go low, we go high, etc. Donald Trump is doing something unusual in American politics, as in he's running on a negative. He is running for president by telling people that their country is a broken down dump, which is an interesting and unusual initiative in American politics. American presidential campaigns especially are all about America's brilliant, let's make it even better.
Reagan, of course, famously positive,
it's morning
sunny
America.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And we're told voters prefer optimism to gloom and doom.
This was my question. Are we about to discover that this has been a grievously mistaken conventional wisdom all this time?
It depends on the times. And I think this the economic times in which Reagan ran in the 80s were a period in which, of course, it was the 70s, all shock and recession and problems in the 1970s. But as in a macro period, the American middle class has suffered far more greatly in terms of relative income and lost anticipated income in the last 15 years than they had in the 15 years before Reagan presented the Morning in America campaign. And I think Trump is tapping into that very deep and serious vein of grievance and concern.
And hatred of the Clintons when Hillary was first lady and hubby was the boss, and hatred of Obama. So I don't think this.
And everybody who's not an angry white male.
So I think Trump campaigning on a negative depiction of the country is getting equated with the people that the Republicans hated having in the White House and do not want to see return to the White House.
Now, final thought from you on this, Shashank. What kind of campaign can or should Hillary Clinton run from here? It's a difficult judgment to make.
I think she will have to be very careful to hold on to as many of those white working class votes as she can as well. It's great that Tim Kaine speaks Spanish and is pulling that out. It's an antidote to the hatred spouted by the Trump campaign. But I think she also has to be aware of this, and that will pull her in directions I find very uncomfortable. She's already come out against TPP despite championing the policy as Secretary of State, and her free trade positions have eroded. I think that's tragic, but I think that's probably a more sensible campaigning style for her as she seeks to keep that mass of votes.
Okay, but we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Rosemary Hollis and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, would you use a humanitarian corridor if the walls were built by Syria and Russia?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
For us here at Monocle, Turkey has a vital position, not just in the Eastern Balkans, but also looking towards the Middle East, towards Central Asia, and towards these countries that are very, very quickly emerging economically. But Turkey also occupies an extremely important role over the next few years, that's in terms of a kind of economic model, and also in terms of city building, as a model of how you make sure that you're building a society that can continue to evolve and change as that population evolves and changes too.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Rosemary Hollis and Shashank Joshi. And let's look now at Syria. Arguably the key battlefield of Syria's civil war has been Aleppo, once Syria's largest city and its commercial hub. What remains of Aleppo is now completely surrounded by Syrian government forces, abetted by Russian airstrikes. And now Syria and Russia are offering to establish what they are calling humanitarian corridors. Three for the 300,000 civilians believed to still be dwelling, somewhat incredibly, in the ruins. And one for rebels offering to lay down their guns, who are also to be offered an amnesty. Rosemary, first of all, is this basically a declaration of victory by Assad?
There's an element of that, but also I think I've long since abandoned believing that any of the external players or Assad have the good of any people that actually lived in and continue to live in Syria in their minds with their strategy. It's all about winning control of Syria. So I would go with all those who are utterly cynical and distrustful of what these humanitarian corridors are meant to achieve.
Shashank, the Russians are promising that these corridors will be accompanied by medicine and food for people who are leaving. How concerned do you think they really are for the well-being of Aleppo's remaining citizens? And I guess those rebels being offered their corridor out of there, how far would you trust the amnesty if you were them?
About as far as I could throw it outside of Aleppo towards Turkey, which is all of a few feet. I mean, I think, of course, they're not concerned about the welfare. We have a record of 5 years of barrel bombing and indiscriminate bombing and incredibly brutal warfare to tell us that's not the motivation here. Nonetheless, there are incentives for a regime to try and get civilians out of a place if, for example, it makes it easier to pound the rebels left in a more straightforward manner whilst incurring less anger from the international community. Of course, it's also good to let rebels have an amnesty if it means you can take a strategic pivotal territory like Aleppo without having to fight for it street by street. So there are perfectly rational motives to try and have these corridors.
Which more or less worked for Assad in terms of Homs, didn't it?
It worked in Homs, it worked for even Iran-backed forces in other parts of Syria near the Lebanese border, where you had entire population swaps that achieved more homogenous ethnic communities. I think, going at the macro level again, why is he doing this now? Is it a declaration of victory? I think they're also pressing home a strategic advantage that came after the proposal by the Americans a few weeks ago that Russia and the US might have joint counterterrorism operations in Syria if they, for example, designated where Nusra was and where Nusra wasn't, so where mainstream rebels were. And I think this, at the headline level, a Syrian rebel on the ground sees one thing and one thing only: US proposes cooperating with Russia and Assad to fight terror in Syria. That is effectively a declaration of victory, because it suggests the US moving towards the Russian position wholesale. Whether that's right or wrong, a rebel on the ground will be more inclined to take a way out at this point than they were before they heard that offer by John Kerry.
Yes, getting out through these corridors, though, because of the way the battle lines have developed over the last several weeks, means that you're pretty much damned if you do and damned if you don't, however, because your choices are to walk into the hands of ISIS or to walk into the hands of this shaping up Russian Assad with some American cooperation front, or alternatively into the hands of the beleaguered Syrian Kurds.
Yes.
And this is not a future.
And by the way, one of the countries providing a key supply line north of Aleppo, which perhaps could have sustained your operations, was Turkey. Turkey has just sacked 40% of its generals and admirals yesterday, and operations in Syria, from what we are reading in the open source, are taking a hit. The Turks are not providing as much assistance.
Turkey does appear to be otherwise occupied. Rosemary, Shashank mentioned there al-Nusra. The other big news out of Syria today today, of course, is their formal split with al-Qaeda and their reconfiguration as something to be known as Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. Why the split and why the rebrand?
Which is the front for the conquest of Syria. It is strategic. It appears to have the blessing of al-Qaeda Central. And it is a move so that the Nusra Front can not be singled out by the Americans and the Russians as bad as al-Qaeda, and therefore one of the problems, that it can it will have less obstacles to joining up with other rebel groups of an Islamist persuasion, get more support from the Gulf Arabs that want anything other than Assad, and thereby complicate whatever strategy it was that the Russians and Americans were cooking up in Moscow last week.
Shashank, is this al-Nusra trying to reposition themselves as I know it's always a relative phrase, as moderates?
Yes, they have always done so, though, of course. In the beginning of the conflict, they have been more nationalist in their posture in Syria than Daesh. They, of course, an outgrowth of al-Qaeda, but they have always had a lot of Syrians in the organization. And, for example, their external operations arm, which we heard a lot about a couple of years ago, that was always kept separate to the rest of the group. You know, with the Yemenis coming over for bomb-making, it was sort of Khorasan. It was kept as a separate entity. So they've always tried to present a moderate face. This is redoubling that effort and saying to other groups, look, you can work with us now, and you won't get bombed by the Americans or blacklisted because we're not al-Qaeda anymore. But of course, what's the value of a split that is blessed by al-Qaeda Central? It strikes me as a complete absurdity, and really, this is still al-Qaeda.
Well, finally tonight, we should move on to something altogether more frivolous, and this is the story which will seem at least slightly familiar to anyone who, probably very late at night, has taken an anxious whiff of something retrieved from the back of the fridge and wonder whether they could get away with spreading it on crackers. Divers exploring a 17th century shipwreck off the coast of Sweden have brought to the surface something that they believe to be cheese. The expedition reports that it smells pretty much like you'd imagine 340-year-old ship's cheese would. Shashank, what does it tell us that this story is getting more traction, including on this broadcaster, for the cheese than any of the other artefacts they have so far brought up from this magnificent shipwreck? It was one of the great vessels of its time, the 126-gun Cronan.
Is it about our perennial need to see how long we can wait before the Stilton has really gone off, or is just very blue after leaving it at Christmas for several months? I mean, there is something about cheese that's sort of wondrous, that it really has this potential to, you don't know when it's gone off because it looks like it was off from the day you bought it from the supermarket. And that's really intrinsically appealing. There's wonderful umami tangy flavours coming off it.
Well, I think it's a phenomenon. I wouldn't have thought it was possible for cheese to be still recognisable as cheese. Well, and we're jumping to the conclusion that it smells, but we don't know.
They've told us that it kind of hums. This we do know for
sure. In between the vomiting, it's really bad.
Well, if you multiply the smell of gone off cheese, let's say it's been off for a month, if you multiply it by the number of months and years that this cheese has been around, I should think it's deadly.
By 12, that's three. Yeah, I mean, that's a long time. I think we can all agree. One of the reasons that we did want to include this item was partly because the producer, Tom, was very fond of doing an in briefly pun at the end. I rose manfully above many other options, including the whole, you know, what a friend we have in cheeses angle. But we did actually want to ask our guests if they have a favourite cheese. Shashank, I'll ask you first.
You have a little bit of Roquefort with a glass of Sauternes, please, for next time, if you're offering.
Okay, but we should totally do that.
I'll ask Tyler Brûlé. He'll solve it.
Ideally less than 340 years old, Rosemary?
I love cheese, and I'm afraid most of the cheese that I love best is from the continent of Europe, so I don't know how I'm going to survive.
Never mind. English cheddar from here on. That's all.
Well, it'll be back to childhood, I'm afraid. Yeah. Yes.
Some very nice Shropshire brie, and you know, you can still get a hold of it.
There's some beautiful English British cheeses. However, I love the creamy brie from France, and I love the some of the blue brie-like cheeses from other parts of the continent. And I shall go there shortly to indulge my preferences.
While you still can. And on that reflective note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Jimena Mignan and Jacob Laderna. Our studio manager was Christopher Grimes. Music next at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and there'll be more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.